asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances.
So if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org.
In recent weeks, we've really focused on some ways that listeners can boost their income. So whether that's through starting your own side business and growing your network like Hala talked about, or when we talked with local realtor Alan about diving into investing in real estate, well, what better way to test the waters? While you are away, your home could also earn extra income.
That's right. Your empty space could be an Airbnb while you're traveling, because that's all you need to become an Airbnb host. It's a lot easier than you think, and you don't need to Airbnb your entire house. You could just host your extra spare room. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com, designed for work.
Welcome to How to Money. I'm Joel.
And I am Matt.
Today, we got to answer your listener questions.
And yes, that is how Joel always talks. At least when we're not recording, that's how he talks. And he buttons it up for the actual episode.
I use the King's English, Matt, when we're doing podcast recording, but it slipped right there.
No, it's Monday, which, dude, I'll say Mondays are the best days because we get to hear from listeners. Like you and I, we create this podcast. On Mondays, we go and get coffee first. But we like sit here all day long, right? You and me. We do a whole lot of reading, a whole lot of writing, and we sit down in front of the microphones and we record. Within that, we can get insulated from, like, the fact that people actually listen to the podcast. And so, like, I mentally know that people listen to the podcast. But when we get to hear voice memos and questions from listeners and then answer those questions, it just reconnects us with you, our listener. And so I'm just going to say a big, massive thanks to everyone out there who's listening to the show. Because, like, truly, we wouldn't have a podcast without listeners. And the fact that folks are sending in their voice memos and trusting, at least... They're looking to hear our opinion. They may not do what we say, but, you know, they're not.
That's okay.
They don't trust us that blindly, Joel.
I'm looking forward to answering questions today and to hearing people's questions. You're right. These touch points matter. Like, I love the Facebook group. That's a touch point for me with our audience. Same with email. Same with listener questions. We love hearing from you and getting your feedback, your questions, like all the above.
It's all good stuff.
Yeah, it really is. And I feel like there used to be like a layer, a buffer between people who created content and then the
not
people.
Anymore, man.
Yeah, now there's not. Like, and I really actually, maybe different people feel different ways about that, but I appreciate it. Like, and I feel like I get a sense of the pulse when I get responses to the newsletter or people who do submit their questions for these episodes. I get an understanding of what people are going through.
100%.
Like, we know what we're going through and what we've been through, and we try to, you know, that use that as kind of part of our impetus for what we talk about. But, you know, hearing what you're going through.
To be out there amongst the people.
Yeah.
All right. I wanted to share a quick little personal confession, Joel, which is...
Okay, Usher.
You know this, but listeners don't know this. I am not going to invest anymore.
Ever again?
Any more money, at least for this year. Okay. So earlier this year, wow. Kate and I... Yeah, hopefully folks aren't freaking out. If you're thinking, oh,
is this
no,
because you're Matt, trying to time the market?
Matt's got a Matt's in his midlife crisis. I am not going to go out and buy a red Corvette, that kind of thing. But Kate and I, we did talk earlier this year, and we decided that, hey, let's hold off investing this year because we've got some other major goals. And specifically, we realized that, hey, if there's a chance of us staying in the house that we're currently in, it would be really, really good for us to add on specifically. I mean, like, the rooms are tiny and the two youngest girls are sharing a bedroom, man. And it's going to quickly become untenable. This was what we realized. And so I wanted to confess that amongst all of the How to Money listeners out there. But I feel very comfortable with that for several reasons. One being, you don't always make decisions like this based on like how to most financially optimize your life, right? Like sometimes
based
you're making,
on how to have the most money in your 80s.
Yes. Like sometimes you have to make decisions that are just like, well, is this going to work for us as a family, as a couple, as an individual? Is this what I want my life to look like? So I'm comfortable with that. I'm also comfortable with the fact that I think there's a decent chance we'll get, if and when we sell the house, the return on the investment might be decent. It's not like we're just completely...
Probably not dollar for dollar,
but we're not just flushing money down the toilet. But also, you consider mortgage rates. Like, the other alternative would be for us to move. And, dude, just given where mortgage rates are right now, it makes that even more difficult.
It makes adding on make more sense.
And it's why so many folks, I think, are hanging on to their properties and potentially doing something like this.
Yeah.
But also, because... early on within our marriage, Kate and I, we invested a whole lot of money, man. We're going to talk later on about savings rate. Same with you and Emily. Like there are certain sacrifices, front loading the sacrifice. We talk about it all the time, but we did a whole lot of that. And, you know, when you're technically Coast Fire, which, you know, I think both of our families have been roughly Coast Fire for a year or two. Well, there's no longer as much of a need to invest if you're like, well, I don't have to invest anymore in order to retire.
I think it's a big part of the puzzle, because some people might hear you say that and they might say, wait, Matt's not going to invest? Like maybe I should dial it back, or maybe I don't need to be saving for my future. And I do think that that is a big part of the equation, is that you're 41, right? And you've done so much heavy lifting on the investing side over the past like 18-ish sort
close
of years.
Close to 20 years trying to like be frugal and make wise decisions. And you can... There's a lot you can do over 20 years.
Yeah. And my guess is you'll probably get back to investing next year. This is literally just a kind of super fund, pay cash for this renovation, and then you'll be back at it, is my guess. So even though your Coast Fire literally means you never have to invest
again.
I probably will. Yeah.
But it's just, I felt the need to share that because, like, I'm not trying to, like, pat myself on the back or anything like that, but just because we talk about investing so often on the show, and it honestly, there's, like, this identity crisis. There's this tension.
Cognitive dissonance.
Yes. That I'm holding within my mind because I'm just like, wait, am I allowed to do that? And so I was thinking through this the other day, and I thought, man, there's a good reason for us to talk about this here on the show. And it's also helpful for me to be, it's self-therapeutic, Joel, for us to have these conversations.
Makes me think, this is probably a month ago, we had a question on the podcast from someone who had been crushing it thoroughly for a long period of time. And it was like, can I stop investing now? And it's like, yeah you can, you know, like we really do. The answer is not always more work, more pay, more investing. Like sometimes the answer is more balance and you know, doing some fun things with that money that are going to improve your life, right?
Totally.
So, all right, Matt, let's mention the beer we're having on this episode. This one is kind of an oldie, but a classic Samuel Smith Nut Brown Ale. I still remember the first Samuel Smith beer I had.
Oh, yeah?
And it was like, it was a game changer for me. I'm curious to see if it holds up because it's been a while since I've had one of theirs.
I didn't realize that it says on the bottom here, product of the UK. So yeah. This is a British ale.
The old Tadcaster Brewery or something like that is what it says. Do you see that on there?
Oh, I see it.
Okay.
Is that what that says?
Yeah. So I'd be curious to know what the brewery
you picked it up because
like.
You thought it said podcaster. Is this a podcaster beer?
My eyesight has deteriorated in these years. But let's move on. Let's get to the listener questions that folks have sent our way. And if you have a question for us, a money question in particular, please do submit yours. Go to howtomoney.com/ask for specific details on how to make that happen. But really, it's just recording a voice memo, sending it to us via email. Hopefully, we can take it next week on the show. Matt, this next question is kind of about optimizing your finances on the biggest purchase of your life.
Hi, Matt and Joel. I hope you're both doing well. My name is Colin, and I'm an avid listener of How to Money out here in Iowa. Your podcast has been instrumental in shaping my approach to personal finance, and I admire the practical wisdom both of you share. I'm reaching out today seeking your advice on a decision my wife and I are grappling with. Currently, we reside in a condo owned by her father where we cover all associated expenses, totaling approximately $1,000 per month. With our diligent savings, we've amassed $50,000 earmarked for a down payment on our future home. However, as a realtor with firsthand experience in property management and home repairs, I find myself contemplating an alternative path. Given our low housing expenses and my familiarity with the real estate market, I wonder if it might be wiser to invest our capital in a rental property instead of purchasing our own residence right away. My wife's remote work setup provides us with flexibility to manage additional properties, and my skill set complements this endeavor. We're at a crossroads and would greatly value your insights on whether to prioritize home ownership or seize the opportunity and enter the real estate investment market. Your perspective would be immensely helpful as we navigate this decision. Look forward to hearing from you guys.
Oh, Joel, I love that Colin said that he is looking to seize the opportunity. This question really gets me excited.
Sounds like capture the flag or something like that.
Oh, yeah. Seize the day. Like, there truly is a massive opportunity here. And, yeah, basically, he's asking here if he and his wife should buy a primary or should they buy a rental home? And, honestly, those decisions most of the time, they're close to being like polar opposites of each other. Like, should I invest money or should I actually spend it?
Right. And should I buy a jet ski company or invest in the company that makes the jet skis?
Yeah. At least in this case, he's looking to buy something that appreciates in value. But real estate owners, like primary owners and investors, they're typically looking at two very different things when you are buying a home. You're kind of buying a small business as an investor, but the considerations and the financial realities of home ownership, as it with it being a primary residence, are often more about buying something that makes sense for you and your family, but that also fits into your budget. Maximizing returns and generating cash flow, those are typically pretty far from mind when you are looking at buying a primary residence for you to live in.
And I think you can be a little more investor-minded when you're buying a primary residence. And for some folks, they've heard us talk about kind of buying the house, living in it, then turning it into a rental property. And if you kind of have that mindset.
So, yeah, that's a way to have your cake and eat it too.
That's right. It's possible to kind of have that approach, but still, most people don't. Let's be honest. Most people watch the TV show House Hunters, and you'll really quickly understand what most people are looking for in a home.
Yeah.
And it has nothing to do with return on investment, at least most of the time.
Yeah.
And so really, we're talking about broccoli versus apples. Like, we're not comparing apples to apples. We're talking about two different food groups, veggies and fruits. But the fact that you're asking this question, Colin, I would say that means that you're keen to put your money to work in a way that would generate returns instead of just trying to maximize your lifestyle, right? And I think that's a good thing. I think that would be taking more the broccoli route, like eating the veggies that you know you're supposed to eat. And it sounds like you've got a pretty sweet deal on rent right now. I like the idea of keeping that bird in the hand and then using the cash you built up to buy a rental instead. I would talk it over with your wife, of course. I'm sure y'all are having this discussion, because no matter how good the deal is, at some point, if you have that desire, that innate desire to own a home, that can outweigh the savings you're currently enjoying, especially if you hit that point in your life where you're like, roots, community, want to be in this one place for a long time to come. That can often tip the scales. Mm-hmm. And maybe just like Matt, who's not investing for a period of time, maybe it makes sense to make the non-optimized choice. But if you guys can agree, at least for the time being, to postpone a primary home purchase, maybe for a few years, buying a rental property before buying a primary, that can offer you more financial flexibility years down the road, for a lot of years to come.
Totally. Yeah, I think it's all about your goals, Colin, because like we all know that kicking the can down the road on a personal or on a lifestyle purchase like this, that can allow all of us to invest more. It allows us to experience some more rapid progress towards our financial goals. But Colin, he also has the tools to be a good investor.
Oh, that's right.
He's gonna save money on realtor fees. That's like a secret little weapon. It's like a superpower that he has.
It is.
And he might know about properties that normal folks wouldn't know about because he's a realtor. He's got connections, his network.
Oh, the word of mouth listings, right?
It's huge.
What do they call it? Pocket listings lots of times?
Pocket listings, exactly. Gosh. The realtor who helped us both buy our homes, Joel, I think he said like 80% of his sales never hit the market.
Yeah.
Because he's pretty entrenched in the community and he knows people. And
so he might just shoot you a text if he knows what you're looking for.
Exactly. But then on top of that, Colin said that him and his wife are both willing to self-manage. He's willing to perform repairs and maintenance in part because of his wife's flexible schedule. He mentioned that as well. So that's pretty sweet. And
the tag team approach, by the way, is super helpful. That's what I found. Like in the beginning, I was usually responding to tenants, finding tenants, managing a lot of the day-to-day. Emily was doing a lot of kind of the bookkeeping, keeping up with the receipts, all that stuff. The stuff I'm really bad at anyway and hate doing. And so
Joel in details, like oil and water.
So not good. So not good. You know this better than most people. And so
I'm your business wife.
Basically. And so, yeah, that combo factor just made it like an easier load. We got to specialize in the things that we enjoyed and that we were better at.
And it's kind of what it sounds like they might be doing as well, because he said he's handy. He can handle repairs. So, yeah, these are all...
It's funny. I wasn't really that either, though. So.
You should give yourself more credit. But I guess all of these things combined makes it seem even more attractive for Colin.
I think the truth is investors who are more hands-on, especially in those early years, they have the ability to maximize returns and to boost your timeline to reach financial independence, right? And these extra tools in Colin's tool belt make this an even better decision, right?
Yeah.
The more you have the ability to turn down the costs that you're going to incur, to self-manage, to increase the productivity, essentially, of this small business that you're buying, which is this rental property, the more you have the ability to oversee it effectively, I think the more it makes sense for you to go that route.
Totally, yeah. So let's talk about another way, though, that you could have your cake and eat it two and do both here in one fell swoop is to opt for a house hack, maybe even like a duplex or a triplex, or maybe a single family home that has a carriage house, an ADU, a basement apartment, something like that. So I would at least consider looking at properties like that if you have the desire for more space and maybe you just don't have to take the elevator up to your place anymore. But also if you want to kind of scratch that rental property itch, I think that's a way of doing it. Don't just consider the standard single family home that maybe you were thinking about before, like, yeah, on the MLS, multifamily housing, like that is your new best friend. But then, yeah, I'm just thinking of your personal network as well, the ability to know of other properties that have some of these income generating possibilities. I think that could be huge for you, Colin.
Yeah, and the longer you're able to stay, keep your cost of living low, the more you're going to be able to funnel into investments, in particular, some of these real estate investments. And that means the more financial flexibility you're going to incur along the way because, hey, guess what? Most years, you're able to increase that rent a little bit. Yeah, the property taxes go up too, but typically your mortgage payment doesn't go up by very much at all. And your rent continues to increase over time. That just means a lot more financial flexibility and the ability to continue to invest more if you want or start to pay down some of that mortgage debt if you're kind of taking more of the Chad Carson approach.
Yeah, Colin is starting his real estate empire, I think, at a young age, just based on how, I don't know, I picture him being a younger listener, that's all.
I think so, sounds like it. And I guess another thing that Colin could do, another approach would be to buy a strict rental duplex right now, right? And look for an income-producing property when the two of you are ready to get out of that condo. So maybe you buy a duplex or a triplex or something like that, you're renting out all of those units, staying in the condo, and then, you know, combine that with your day jobs, the income from this rental property, you can build up that nest egg really quickly for the next place you want to buy. And then maybe that's when you buy the single family home with the ADU and boom, look at all of the income producing properties then you have in your life just because you delayed this purchase just a little bit and you made the smart investing move on the front end. This sacrifice you're making and the prioritization of investing before buying pays dividends for decades.
Yeah.
So I love that Colin would be willing to kind of put that off for a little bit, make the what I would say is like the harder move when you've got that kind of cash saved up. Most people would say it's time to start looking at the home that we want to be in for the next 5 to 10 years.
Home of our dreams.
Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. And going back to, you said this at the very beginning, but I think for him and his wife, like finding a single family home that they know that they're going to convert into a rental property could be a really smart way as well, because there's multiple benefits that you get there by being an owner occupant. You're going to get a better rate. That's pretty sweet.
Yeah.
By living like, I even hate saying this, but you're not throwing away rent dollars, but because like by living there and making your mortgage payment for a couple of years, you're going to be building up equity. And so that's the sweet advantage there as well. But then you've got the lifestyle advantage as well, where it's like, okay, sweet. We've got a backyard for the dog. Oh, now there are some of those other more tangible lifestyle benefits that you would experience as well. And so what that means though, is looking at homes while you're house shopping, not just through a lens of what would we like to live in, but actually, what'll work for now? What'll work for the next couple of years? Because you're not buying the house of your dreams. You're buying a home maybe for the next couple of years. And then after that, what you're hopefully looking for is a property that's going to appreciate. You're looking to buy in an area that's going to, man, this part of town is going to really turn around. Oh, yeah, I know about, because I've got my connections and because he's a realtor, he knows about another house further up the street that somebody's moving into, or he knows about a commercial deal that just went down in the little square, and it's actually going to be a coffee shop, and all of a sudden this little neighborhood is going to start blossoming. That's the kind of property you want to get in on now before a lot of that appreciation happens.
Yeah, and that is, I think, thinking of kind of like we said at the beginning, your primary home purchase with more of an investor mentality. And I do think that more How to Money listeners would be wise to do that, to say, cool, is there a way I can force appreciation into this property? Most primary homeowners aren't thinking along those lines. They're typically thinking, do the walls have fresh paint on them now? Like, how does the home look when I tour it now? Like, instead of seeing with that vision, the eye for the future.
Exactly.
And I think if you can think of, as a buyer even of a primary home, a little more with that investor lens, you're going to be better off over the long haul. Even if it means putting in some of that sweat equity yourself and building up the home with over time with your own efforts.
That's right.
So best of luck to you, Colin. Let us know what you end up doing. Matt, we've got more questions to get to. And since we're on the housing front, let's talk about, when do you sell investments in order to fund a down payment? We'll talk about that and more right after this. Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simon's on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host. Spring cleaning is kind of an annual rite of passage. We've all got to do it, minimize the junk that we have in our house. Emily and I, we just cleaned our closets out. It took hours, but it was so worth it. Now we've only got stuff in there that we love, and it's easier to find everything too. And so, you know, while cleaning your closets is helpful, well, there's something else you can do for your family this spring. Shopping for life insurance with Policy Genius, for example, is a really important part of your financial planning for the year.
That's right. Yeah. And here is the thing that's important to remember, because you might be thinking you don't need to check out Policy Genius because you've got a policy through work. But even if you have a life insurance policy through your job, it may not offer you enough protection for your family's needs, and it may not follow you if you leave your job. With Policy Genius, you can find life insurance policies that start at just $292 per year for $1 million of coverage. Some options offer same-day approval and avoid unnecessary medical exams. Policy Genius works for you, not the insurance companies, and that means they don't have an incentive to recommend one insurer over another, so you can trust their guidance.
Save time and money and provide your family with a financial safety net using Policy Genius. Head to policygenius.com to get your free life insurance quotes and see how much you could save. That's policygenius.com.
All right, we're back from the break. It seems like we've got a housing theme going on with this episode, because later on we're going to talk about whether or not 15-year mortgages are mistakes or not. But before we get to that one, let's hear from a listener in Wisconsin.
Hey, Matt and Joel, this is Ashley from Madison, Wisconsin, though originally from Texas. We moved here for my husband's residency and will actually be moving again for his fellowship in Chicago for the next 2 years. I've been listening to you guys since 2018 when I was just out of college and totally lost on all things investing. Well, with your advice over the years, I've come to a great problem to have. So I will want to buy a house at least a year after my husband is done with training, probably in 3 to 4 years. We've been able to save a lot in retirement accounts as well as taxable brokerage accounts, which have seen some really high gains. And then any cash on hand is our emergency fund, and I've set aside our car payment, which is paid off soon. My question is, how do I go about selling investments for my down payment? Should I prioritize selling funds with the smallest gains? Do I do all of it at once? And then how much do I sell? And how do I easily estimate the tax liability? Also, I will be transitioning to stay at home with our daughter for the next 2 years, and we will most likely break even with my husband's salary and expenses in Chicago. Mind you, we are pretty frugal people. I really appreciate all the work you put into this podcast, and I look forward to hearing your thoughts.
So, Joel, obviously we're going to answer Ashley's question as asked, but it's also worth pointing out that, I mean, she is specifically looking at how or when she should be selling investments for, like you said, a down payment. But I think we can even broaden this question a little bit just as to when should I sell? How do I go about selling investments for any sort of medium term goal?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, there's just like so many factors you have to run that decision to sell investments through before you just kind of say, all right, let's do it.
Sure.
You don't want an itchy trigger finger and just like, oh, wait, the market looks frothy or something like that. Guess I'll sell my investments because I'm trying to time the market or something like that. I mean, I think that is one risk that people run. I feel like there's more questions we're getting now because of the extreme market rise we've seen about selling investments and whether or not it makes sense. And but let's just say this, Ashley's in a great position here, right? The fact that she's put so much effort into investing over the past few years will make it easier to dial back in a little while for them as they move down to one income. It's always tough to go from two paychecks to one, but they have prepared well for this transition, right? And this is just another reason to start investing early, often, and to work towards having a high savings rate, because you never know what life is going to hold and when you might need to cut back dramatically, when your goals are going to shift in a serious way. Maybe you get pregnant with triplets. Can you imagine that, Matt? I mean, that's going to change everyone's life in a big way, and it's going to change your finances in a big way. Nobody maintains, of course, a strict 15% savings rate in and out every single year for their entire life. You got to roll with the punches. And for you, Matt, your savings rate has been significantly higher than that for so many years. Most people haven't earned that flexibility because their savings rate is so paltry to begin with.
That's true. Yeah. So for Ashley specifically, when it comes to selling some of the different investments that you have, you're not going to want to sell anything that are in tax advantaged accounts. And so definitely keep those locked up because the penalties and the tax that you'd have to pay would be very prohibitive to that making any sense at all. And so we're really talking about selling some of the holdings within a taxable brokerage account. And even then, we're only talking about positions that you've held for at least 365 days because crossing the threshold from short-term capital gains to long-term capital gains is going to reduce your taxable burden.
Hold it for 364. Sorry, you have to pay ordinary income tax, right?
That's right, yeah. And then you talked about how much to set aside for those long-term capital gains that you're going to be experiencing, not the short-term capital gains. It's actually not all that hard to do the math on that. Just make sure that you have 15% of the total sale amount in cash come tax time next year. You'll be prepared.
That's right. Basically, just a little under a year from now, you will need to have that money to pay the IRS. You cash out $100,000 in gains, specifically in gains, not just the amount you cash out. That is, you'll owe $15,000 in tax come this time next year.
And even not specifically next year, but whenever it is that you actually make the sale.
If you make the sale in tax year 2024.
That's right. Yeah, because maybe you don't make the sale at all. Maybe you change your mind.
That's right.
And something else happens. So
Right.
I think that's worth keeping in mind as well.
So she also asked about how much she should sell and when. And she basically said that this money isn't urgently needed. We're talking about 3 to 4 years from
now.
So it's probably not going to take place.
That's a really nice runway of time to be able to look into the future and start preparing. I really like the time frame that she's got.
Yeah. So if you needed the money a whole lot sooner, let's say you were like, no, we're going to need it like this year, next year. I would want to make more of a swift exit. I would be more concerned about letting that money ride in the stock market. But as it is, I think what I would do, Matt, I would take a dollar cost averaging approach. This is exactly the way most people get into the market, putting dollars in with every paycheck every 2 weeks. Well, why not take the same sort of approach, selling funds every month or every 2 weeks until you get to that desired amount? And it also just means you're not trying to time the market. You're selling funds consistently, no matter what, just like you would buy them. And then I'd also be setting aside extra cash along the way. Like, you know, she mentioned the car note. Once that's paid off, set aside those dollars into a savings account. And maybe that means you actually have to sell fewer investment dollars if you can save more cash along the way, right?
Yeah. Yeah. The first time I listened to her question, like before I listened to the whole question, I was just like, well, no, don't sell any investments. Actually just save up the money. But then she talked about how they would basically just break even because of their living expenses and the fact that they've got a reduced income. But obviously, that would be more ideal, is to not have to take any investments out as opposed to being able to sit on that cash.
Because when you do take investments out, you're interrupting, what is it? Is it Warren Buffett's rule?
Or Munger, I think.
Munger, okay. Uh-huh. You're interrupting compounding unnecessarily.
That's right.
But then again, you can have such a focus like Buffett and Munger, and your investments skyrocket over time, and yet you have a hard time finding yourself able to enjoy the results, the fruits of those returns.
Sure. Yeah. So you mentioned dollar cost averaging by exiting the market. I would actually do something differently if it was me personally, because what is important to keep in mind, and this is why I was looking to the fact that she said that they're looking at 3 to 4 years out from now, and that's that the market 3 out of 4 years goes up. And so honestly, if it was me, and actually, if you are willing to take on perhaps a little more risk, you have a higher chance. The odds are in your favor. You have a higher chance of your investment actually increasing in value were you to just leave it in the market over the next 3 to 4 years. That's going to be a personal decision, though, because...
But will the market outpace savings and CDs over the next few years?
Who knows?
Who knows? Especially with those rates are elevated.
Yeah, but on average, I mean, it's... I guess the Fed hasn't announced that they're going to cut rates yet, but there is a chance that those rates could come down. And when you look at historical averages, I mean, the S&P, like, you're looking at over 10% over the long haul. And so it comes down to, if you could stomach the market tanking and you needing that money, that's the risk that you're basically taking on, because it's not guaranteed. But since the 50s, that is the return that you can expect from the S&P.
And that's where dollar cost averaging helps take a little bit of that emotional risk off the table.
It de-risks, for
right?
sure.
And so, yeah, you're saying, listen, I'm willing to miss out on some of the potential upside to ensure that I don't experience the real potential hardship of a bear market for multiple years on end. And so much of that comes down to, I guess, your personality, your personal risk tolerance, mm-hmm. and how important it is. Like, well, I don't know, could you be flexible in some of those goals on when you quit your job? If not, you might want to make sure you're taking the less risky approach.
Yeah. Yeah. Another reason I think that if it was me that I would wait to pull that money out is, like you said, like your flexibility, but also there's a chance that, I mean, I think her husband's a doctor. What if he gets like a fat, sweet signing bonus in order to go to a certain hospital, and he takes that, and all of a sudden they find themselves with more cash on hand? What if she stepped out of work, right, in order to take care of the baby? What if her former employer is just like, hey, we really need you back, $25,000 signing bonus, boom. What if there is an inheritance or parents that want to gift them money a few years from now? There are all these other things that could lead to you actually having more cash on hand than you realize or that you're expecting now. And granted, I don't want you to count on receiving those funds down the road, but all of those situations could lead you to a situation where you have sold investments over the past 3 to 4 years, all the while paying long-term capital gains tax on that. And now you're like, dang it, I wish I would have left that money invested, because I actually don't need it right now.
Yeah. Yeah. So it's hard to predict some of those things.
It's tough,
right?
to know. Yeah.
yeah. So,
but all things to consider.
Yeah. I guess those are all things to weigh in your mind as to when, how much you end up taking out from your taxable brokerage account. And of course, taxable brokerage accounts can be great for medium-term investing goals, like buying a house. For instance, for any How to Money listeners out there, and they're wondering, well, what should I do if I'm saving up for a down payment? Well, a taxable brokerage account is the right answer if mm-hmm. you're 5+ years off from buying a house, right? If you're like, I'm 18 months off from buying a house, well, the high yield savings account is probably the better answer.
That's right.
But the other thing too, Matt, to consider is that if Ashley and her husband can hit the 20% mark when it comes to how much they're able to put down on the property that they're buying, it'll reduce the amount they need to borrow, which is even more helpful given how high interest rates are.
That's right.
And, you know, also will help them to avoid PMI, which is another pesky monthly fee. So those are all things worth considering too. If you take out enough to get to 15% down, but then you end up paying those other things, well, it might have been worth taking more money out of investments and interrupting that compounding, not just for the lifestyle goals you have, but also to save money and fees in other ways.
I like the fact that she's almost practicing taking money out of the market by funding this short-term goal of hers that also most likely will increase in value, because I feel like that you can get sucked into this trap of thinking, oh, anytime you sell investments, that's a bad thing. But like, this is precise, like we're pointing out the fact that a brokerage account is good for medium-term goals. It's precisely what it's designed for, mm-hmm. because if you're talking long-term, well, that's what retirement accounts are for, and they've already got those funded. And so this is like exactly what this brokerage account should be used for.
She's
and
using the account as prescribed, essentially.
Exactly. And when it comes to which investments to sell, honestly, I wouldn't think too much about how much they've appreciated or not. Instead, I think about which investments that you have the most faith in moving forward. So I'm not sure if you own any individual stocks or a bunch of like sector specific ETFs, but I would ask myself, which funds would I buy first with any extra cash on hand today, and just keep those around and sell the others. I think this could be a good opportunity to potentially cull some of your investing mistakes if you feel like you've made any. And then, you know, selling the losers will, up to a certain point, that'll help you out from a tax standpoint as well. So something to keep in mind. I wouldn't be too concerned over what it is that you're selling.
Yeah, agreed. So Ashley, I feel like our answer in so many ways here is choose your own adventure, but hopefully we gave you enough thoughts to help you choose wisely. Matt, let's get to our next question. This one, it comes from a listener. He homebrews great beer, and he's got a nerdy question about savings rates.
Hey, Matt and Joel. This is Graham from Atlanta, aka your local homebrew supplier. On a previous episode, a caller asked if 401k match should be considered as part of their savings rate. I personally include the match as part of my total income and do include it as part of my savings rate calculations. My question is this. Should folks consider 529 plan contributions as part of their overall savings rate? On one hand, the beneficiary of a 529 plan can be changed to any family member, including oneself, at any time. But the purpose of most folks' 529 plans is for the benefit of someone other than themselves. Similarly, how would you classify the saving that folks do for a large purchase or for gifts for the holiday season? Perhaps a better question is, what qualifies as saving versus not saving? Thanks for all that you do. And I would like to cast my vote for the next How to Money Atlanta meetup for the beer garden behind Brickstore Pub or Contrast Artisan Ales in Chamblee.
Graham, great to hear from you. And we will definitely get another Atlanta meetup, beer meetup on the calendar soon. He mentioned...
But only if he brings us more homebrew.
Some homebrew. No, you don't have to do that, Graham. The first...
Actually, he does.
He brewed us Frou-Frou Gal. Remember? We completely... We should have like turned in our dad cards for not getting that pun.
Yeah.
The name of the beer was Frou-Frou Gal.
At least suspended for 6 months.
He had to email us and was like, dudes, it was... Frugal or Frou. Yeah, I don't exactly know how you say it, but basically it's a frugal pun. I love it. You mentioned the Brickstore. We love that as well. And also you mentioned Artisan Ales.
Contrast Artisan Ales.
Contrast Artisan Ales. We're actually going to get one of those near us. I guess it's their second location.
I'm very excited.
Me too, because we don't have the best craft beer. We went from being in town where it was hip, where all the great beer was, to someplace where there's not great craft
beer. We're in a craft beer desert, and that's about to change.
That's true. But the savings rate talk or chat continues, because Graham says that a 401k match should definitely be considered as part of your savings rate, which we're okay with, as long as it elevates your desire to, I think, reach a higher savings rate. Because if you get, let's say, a 6% match from your employer, and you've heard us say that, hey, shoot for 15%. And so what you then end up doing is bumping the total amount that you're socking away down to 9%, just so you kind of like plateau at 15%.
Yeah.
I think that may not be, and like, that's not what we're trying to encourage you to do. We're not setting a limit, like an upper limit. We're trying to set like a lower limit.
It's like
we don't want you to go any below 15%, and anything above that is gravy.
Yeah, I think it's letter of the law versus spirit of the law too, right? And there is that sort of going with, I don't know, I'm going to get in trouble for this, but going with the flow of traffic instead of just going the speed limit sign if you're holding everybody up. At least in Atlanta, we know that quite well, and you're more likely to get an accident if you're going 55 in certain sections.
If you're following the letter of the law and going exactly the speed limit, you will cause wrecks.
I will get negative emails for that. But I think this is the same
thing. Send that to Joel. Right. Joel is the one who advocates for speeding on our interstates.
It's me. It's my fault. So
and in school zones, too. I've seen him do that.
No. But the letter of the law versus spirit of the law, right? There's some things where when we say 15% and you're like, oh, how can I craftily make sure I'm hitting that by doing the bare minimum? Well, you're not going to have as much flexibility as some of the other people, some of the listeners to the show who are saying, well, how can I increase my savings rate to opt for maximum flexibility and to reach greater levels of financial independence a little bit sooner? And that doesn't mean breaking your back with a hardcore fire-centric sort of approach, but I think it does mean probably challenging yourself a little bit and not just doing the bare minimum, even though you can, I guess, if that's what you want to do. And I think if you're only saving 15%, which again, we want to be the floor, if that's what's going into your retirement account, that's really good. But you'll also likely find you're keeping debt around longer than you probably should, or that you're not able to save for some of those more medium term goals very well, like buying a car with cash. And yeah, so I guess we don't mind you including it in your savings rate, as long as you ensure that your savings rate floor moves higher.
So I don't know if this is semantics, but what you're pointing to is the fact that, hey, you should be saving more so that you can achieve some of those medium-term goals. Is that what you're saying?
Yeah.
So what you're saying then is that, so this is to Graham's other question, is that those medium-term goals, like a vacation or something like that, that should be included in your savings rate. Is that what you're saying? Because you've kind of lumped it into the savings rate.
Okay, so I guess a vacation I would see as a different thing altogether, because I think of that as a short-term goal, something that probably should be in your budget every single month that you're saving for, whatever that vacation is, in August or something
like
that.
You go on vacations every month? Or no?
I'm saying you should be, if it's a $5,000 vacation, you should be setting aside a little over $400 every single month.
I get that.
Whereas the car, man, I'm hoping I don't know, until the Rivian comes out in 2026, but most of the time, I'm hoping that I buy a car every 8 or 10 years, something like that. And because of that, I think of that as adding to my savings rate, because sure, I'm saving up for a potential car purchase. I don't know how much it's going to cost or when I'm going to need to pull the trigger and buy that thing. But I am thinking of all the money that I'm socking into liquid savings, not just investments, as part of my savings rate, even though eventually at some point I'll need to access it.
I guess this is where personal finance is personal, because like the way I think about vacations up until, I guess, fairly, you know, more recently, is that we were never sure if we were going to take a vacation every single year. Like there were some years where we spent like a ton of money on, because it's like, hey, we're going to go to Europe for 3 weeks, which is something Kate and I did like before we had kids. But then there's years where we didn't go on vacation at all. So in my mind, I pictured vacations truly a lot like you picture buying a new car, because I'm like, it's this unknown variable. It's like, oh, maybe we'll go a little bit, or we'll go to the beach, like that kind of thing. But
I think most people budget a certain amount for that. They've got an idea in mind. A lot of people go back to the same place. It is, for most people at least, they think of it as like a recurring annual expense.
Yeah. I mean, personally, I guess in so much of this, I think, has to do with
what I'm saying is you're weird.
maybe so. But like, I feel like my relationship to my savings rate is very fluid, because being self-employed virtually my entire adult career, having a very fluctuating income meant that my savings rate varied wildly. Like some years it was massive, but then some years it was pretty lean. But what that means though is that the additional income that I had to set aside towards something like a vacation, towards something like a nicer car or a vehicle or maintenance, just different things that you save up for, it varied on how much money we had left over after setting aside a base floor amount for investing. And so that's why me personally, I don't include those medium term goals within my quote unquote savings rate, because I want to create a floor that where I'm like, okay, no matter what, I'm always going to set aside 15%, mm-hmm. if not more, towards long-term retirement investing.
Yeah.
So for me, I don't know, and maybe it's like a nerdier way, like super by the books, or you know, very black and white way of seeing the world. But Graham, I don't know if that's helpful for you, but that's how I look at it, at least.
Yeah. So I mean, really, this question of what is savings is actually more complex than it might seem on its face.
Yeah.
You know?
Yeah. It really is.
You might think that's simple question, guys. Let me tackle that one for you. But I think when you delve into it a little bit further, you're like, wait, does paying off high interest debt, does that kind of count as savings? And I guess the answer is probably no, but it's...
But it's not consumption. It's not living expenses for this month.
Right.
So in that way, it kind of feels like savings.
When we're always talking, about growing the gap, part of that is funneling more money towards paying off the debt. And if you had like a minimum 15% savings rate and you're funneling money into investments, but it means you're keeping around high interest rate debt even longer, well, then you want to go dip into your savings rate for a little bit and reduce it so that you can pay off that high interest rate debt.
Yeah.
It is a tricky conundrum. But I think you know, saving and investing are both kind of forms of delayed spending too, right? So the goal is to eventually, you know, maybe kind of sort of die with zero, right? As Bill Perkins would say, the goal isn't to store up sums of money so that we can hand it down to our heirs when we eventually pass away. And you know, debt is essentially the opposite. You're prolonging the pain of a purchase. But then savings, I think, Matt, savings is also more than that. It's almost a little, I think of it in an existential way. I think of it as a recognition that we have more than we need. And the ability to set aside larger amounts of money feels like a countercultural act in today's America.
That's true.
We talked about this recently. The average savings rate of everyday Americans, it's paltry. It's pathetic. I think savings has this dual impact. Living on less allows us to reach higher levels of financial independence more quickly. And it also just allows us to be comfortable living on less, too.
That's right. And then Graham, okay, let's talk about the 529 part of your question. Should that be considered part of your savings rate? Well, I kind of think so, because even if you aren't saving for yourself, you're still putting those dollars aside. And honestly, I think for me, that's the biggest difference, is that money that you're quote unquote saving, are you setting it aside for more near term use, like a savings goal, or are you investing it? And guess what? All the money I've got set aside for my kids in 529 accounts isn't, in fact, set aside. It is actually invested. And that's why, for me, the savings rate includes 529s, because I'm investing those dollars.
But why does your savings rate only include investments?
I think it's just the, at some point, what am I going to live off of? My investments. And so it's about saving for the, it's just like the squirrels, like, I don't know, storing up the storing up the acorns for the long winter.
Distinguish between saving and investing. And there are savings accounts, right, that we put money into for kind of the, that's where this gets so tricky, right?
Yeah, yeah. Well, because there's not an investing rate. Like, no one calls it that. Right. They call it a savings rate. And I think most people, when they say a savings rate, what they're referring to, though, is an investing rate. That's how I picture it, at least. But if others out there, if you're lumping in Christmas, because guess what? That's a big expense and it happens every year. That's fine.
See,
if you do that.
I think that's different, because I think that's something you expect every single year. You need to be budgeting for that. You need to be setting aside money for that, like you just said. But you're also saving for other things that aren't just post 59 and a half lifestyle. And that's where you have to have some room, I think, to include other elements of saving in your savings rate. And I don't know, maybe we've just kind of
beating the dead
horse.
But
I'm with you on the 529 accounts, and I would also count that into my savings rate. And but this is also, Matt, why we de-emphasize 529 plans so much on the show. Yes, of course, they've gotten better with recent rule changes allowing you to turn some of those $529 dollars into Roth IRA dollars for your kids in future years. But the main goal of saving money is for your own financial freedom. And, you know, 529 plans, they are reserved for Money Gear 7. And by the way, there are only 7 money gears. They're reserved for that final gear, not because you want your kids to take on loads of student loan debt or anything like that, but because they're only really appropriate if you've been crushing your own finances for quite a long while, which likely means you've had a high savings rate, and now you can dial back on personal investments in order to invest in the next generation. Or maybe you've just got the ability to expand your savings rate and do both at the same time.
Oh, which, okay, so a whole other can of worms just opened up in my mind, which is donor advised funds, because is that money considered, say, because it's money that you've given away, but you're in fact investing it. Maybe we just won't go there. We'll say that for another episode.
It is more complex than we give it credit for. And hopefully we got people's brains thinking about how they calculate their own savings rate.
I think more than anything, that's what I want people to leave this particular question with, is the fact that, man, there are so many different ways to engage and to think about your own money. And that's what I love about personal finance, is you can kind of customize it, chop it up, slice it, partition it however you want, and specifically however it makes the most sense to you, because it's your money. But Joel, we've got another question to get to. We're going to talk about whether or not the 15-year mortgage, whether that's a mistake. We'll get to that and more right after this.
Asking the right questions can greatly impact your future, especially when it comes to your finances. So, if you're looking for a financial advisor you can trust, certified financial planner professionals are committed to acting in your best interest. They are committed to high ethical standards and even had to pass a rigorous exam before they could become a CFP professional.
They offer financial planning and services that take a more comprehensive view of your financial and personal circumstances and are customized for your needs. Certified financial planner professionals can offer advice on a wide range of issues, like reviewing your investment portfolio's allocation, handling an inheritance, rolling over a company retirement plan, building education savings, and so much more.
That's why it's got to be a CFP. Find your CFP professional at letsmakeaplan.org. I'm guessing that a lot of listeners are starting to solidify their summer travel plans. We always like to get the families together, Matt, for a week at the beach. Every single summer, we've already got that trip to St. Simons on the calendar. Pumped for that. But sometimes those vacations get expensive. So what better way to offset some of those costs than to have your home earning some money while you're away?
That's right. Why let it sit empty when it could be earning extra income? It's the financially smart thing to do. So think it through. Maybe you've got some extra space in your home, or maybe you have an entire house to host, or maybe you're just going on vacation and your home is sitting empty. In every case, you can Airbnb it. You already have the space, so it won't be a huge adjustment.
I mean, the way I see it, if you're not using your space, you have two options. You can let it just sit there empty, or you do some optimizing and make some money off it. Really, if you think about it, you already have an Airbnb. You just need to start using it. Your home might be worth more than you think. Find out how much at airbnb.com/host.
If you're listening to this podcast right now and you're a small business owner, listen up. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're actually choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers. They do everything from hyper-targeting best fit prospects through campaign optimization. Upswell Marketing's unique approach includes direct mail, search engine marketing, and social media ads, and has fueled more than 10,000 small business success stories. Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no-obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies. Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
All right, man, we are back, and we always have our Facebook question of the week. I feel like we always try to live our life without any regrets, but this listener, this question, they're wondering if maybe they've made that mistake.
They're looking in the rearview mirror, and they're like, what have I done?
What have I done? Did I make the right decision? This anonymous person said, wondering if I made the right decision about my mortgage a while back, bought my house right before the pandemic with a 4% rate, 30-year term, and was paying PMI at $177 a month. About 2 years later, when the rates dropped and home values increased, I refinanced for 2.375% for 15 years and was able to drop the PMI, which is always, that's a good thing. The savings from the PMI and the rate drop coupled with the shorter term meant that I was only paying an extra $320 a month. At the time, I thought it was worth it to pay a little extra and finish that much sooner, but I didn't think of the overall monthly payment difference. I'm wondering if the shorter term was the right decision. I hated the idea of paying a higher rate than the 2.375, although not significantly higher and still under 3%. But what I hated more was the idea of going from having 28 years left back up to 30. I love the idea of being mortgage-free in 15 years, but now I'm thinking the 30 years would have allowed me to save and or invest more. And if I went from the remaining 28 years to a new 30-year term, my monthly payment would have been $720 less. Instead, I'm paying $320 more. It's a big difference there. Should I have used that extra $1,000 $40 somewhere else? Joel, what do you think? I think a lot of folks are finding themselves in a situation like this where they're just like, oh man, because
did I make the right move?
Yeah, it's difficult to know.
Well, it's hard to predict the future, right? This is totally a hindsight is 2020 sort of question. We can all look back at our life and not just on matters of personal finance. And by the way, this is should be a minor regret, if a regret at all, because it's of how small it is, right? And nobody is typically crying about having a rate that's under 2.5% these days. But at that point in time, it was really hard to predict the future. We didn't know mortgage rates were going to skyrocket and that you would be able to earn more in a basic high yield savings account than what your mortgage rate was. Because Matt, back then, what savings rates were paying were like 0.5%.
Yep.
They were trash. It was really bad. And so locking in low interest rate debts for longer, well, it seems smarter today than it did in the moment. But I did something very similar, Matt. And if I could go back and do it over again, I probably would change my route. But I refied multiple investment properties into 15-year notes, and I kind of balanced it with refying other rental properties into 30-year notes. In the moment, it seemed really reasonably smart. I'd trade the 15-year loans for 30-year loans if I could go back in time, freeing up that cash, right? Because of the ability to earn more, not just in savings, but to funnel more into investments. But back then, long-term interest rate debt just didn't seem as good as it does today. And I get that it's hard not to feel like it was a mistake, but I'm pretty sure you're not going to feel all that bad when you pay off your mortgage ahead of most of your peers either.
I will point to the fact that you mentioned funneling dollars, additional dollars into investments as well, because even though we could not have foreseen, like let's just say the past five, even the past 10 years of what the market would do, we still know historical data. And that's the part that I have a tough time, I guess, getting past. Because again, since the 50s, the S&P 500 has annualized over 10%. And does that mean it's guaranteed to continue at that rate? Absolutely not. But that is the historical data that we have, which is literally why, I guess you and I, we have slightly different takes, but I refinanced from a 15-year to a 30-year because, like, in my mind, I'm like, rates are really low. And granted, I'm paying more than certainly paying more on a 30-year note than I would a 15. It still, in my mind, felt like the right decision for us because I'm like, I want to keep that mortgage around as long as possible, knowing that I would invest that money, right? Mm-hmm. Knowing that I would invest that difference. And that's in my mind, that is the key distinction, because would you have actually done that? And I think for a lot of folks, the answer is, like, maybe they think they would, but it's difficult to know whether or not they would invest the difference. And that is why the forced savings method that homes that it requires of you. That's why it's the number one tool for people building their wealth in America. We don't love that that's the case, but it's because if you don't pay your mortgage, if you don't pay, you can't stay. Like, you are forced to pay your mortgage.
And you'll skimp on everything else, including 401k contributions, to make sure you're able to continue to pay that mortgage.
Yeah.
And
yeah.
You're right. I think the 30-year note.
But I wanted to mention that because even like 5 years ago when here on the show, like we were encouraging folks to refinance it. Like we were saying, hey, generally speaking, this is the anomaly, and we are used to it because it feels like that this is all we've known, because it truly was all we had known since...
Talk of negative interest rates. You remember that?
It's almost like Japan or something like that. Right. But since 2009, 2010, those were the rates that we knew, and it felt normal. But at least I recall on the show, like we were telling folks to please refi because this is not normal. And I guess that historical data is what we want folks to keep in mind. Like, take the long view. Don't be swayed by the headlines and what it is that folks are talking about today, but just truly look at the historical data and to essentially wayfair yourself, to figure, as you're trying to pinpoint where you are on the map with your money.
My guess is too that this poster, because of the specificity of the numbers here, 1,040, like they didn't say somewhere in the $1,000 range. Like, they've run the numbers. They know how much they would have had on hand, and that they would have, in all likelihood, used that money to do better things.
Maybe they would have been disciplined and kind of, forced it into the market.
Like you're saying, though, depends on who you are, how you handle your money, what you do with extra money that comes in.
Totally.
And if you're of the bent to increase your savings rate, funnel that into your 401k, your Roth IRA, like max out your HSA, whatever, if you're going to do those, take those steps with it, and you could maybe afford a 15-year mortgage, which is awesome, but you opt for the 30 so you can do better things with that money, I think that is a reasonable and potentially an excellent choice. But if you are of the other bent and you're like, I can barely afford this house even on a 30-year note, lots of times that just gives people license to buy more house than they should.
That's true. Yeah. I mean, at the end of the day, like, I don't think it was a mistake for this individual. It depends on what you're optimizing for, because if you optimize for peace of mind, knowing that I owe my home free and clear, nobody can take that away, if that's what you're optimizing for, then awesome, that's great. And a lot of really smart people do that. We recently talked with Marco about Bitcoin on the show. That's something that he's done. Morgan Housel, one of the smartest minds in personal finance right now, wrote The Psychology of Money. He has done that. We've known other folks who have paid off their house, not just gone for the 15-year, but literally paid off their home so that they don't have any debt on their home. But if you are optimizing for the most financial return, like, that's where I have a hard time looking past the historical data. Ultimately, like, I mean, you can't go back in time. In either case, you are doing really well, especially compared to the rest of America. And I think that is more important to focus on, the fact that you are still head and shoulders above what the majority of folks are doing.
Yeah, and I do think that the poster is right. I don't know if it's he or she, actually. It's anonymous. But I think the poster is right to talk about kind of going back to the starting line when you refinance. Let's say you've paid on your loan for 5-6 years. In this case, it was just 2. But then you refinance back into another 30. It does feel like you're starting from square one.
Feels like time lost.
And that can be a tough financial reality and also a tough psychological reality. So
I think
in that case, I also understand the impetus to try to actually accelerate that payoff, move things forward into a 15-year note instead of a 30. And clearly this poster is in the good fortune of being able to afford that higher payment. And then hopefully they're also able to do enough great things saving and investing regularly also.
Yeah. Yeah. You can't underestimate the accountability that having a mortgage payment like that, because again, it goes back to what would you have done? And it's tough to know without there being some sort of alternate reality, which is of course impossible. But all right, Joel, you want to talk about Nut Brown Ale, the Samuel Smith's beer that you and I both enjoyed on our show?
Like I said at the beginning, this brewery, I feel like I stumbled upon them early in my kind of craft beer newbie days, and I really enjoyed their stuff. And so I was like, oh man, I saw this and I was like, it gave me a little bit of bite of nostalgia.
Yeah, nostalgia vibes.
And I was like, we gotta try this one out on the show. And this has nutty, light brown vibes, but it's not as good as I remember it. It's just and I just have this vision in my head of what it used to taste like, and it doesn't taste like that
anymore.
It's
pretty good.
It's good, but it's just I don't know. I was in love with this beer back in the day.
Did you have a story as to when the first time you enjoyed this beer?
No, there was just this beer store like right in the heart of the city, heart of Atlanta, that I would go to, and I just remember there was like they had a porter. There was the winter welcome that would come out just in like around Christmas time. And I just remember like loving every single one of them. They had this unique flavor profile, kind of a thread running between all those beers. Interestingly enough, even though they were different styles,
They just tasted awesome. Because it wasn't Bud Light or
because it was way better than anything else I'd ever had.
It makes me think, it's funny because one of the early craft beers, quote unquote craft beers, that I found myself gravitating towards was a brown ale as well. Abita's Turbo Dog was a favorite of mine. That was one of my favorite shower beers. Living up in the woods of North Carolina in the house that we rented had a window that you could open into the shower. And so literally, it was awesome, man. I would come in from chopping wood. Like, literally, that's how we heated our house.
Mountain man.
Splitting wood. And take a shower, open the window to the great outdoors, and I would have the beer sitting there on the shelf while taking a hot shower. Didn't that sound great?
Sounds pretty lovely.
Shower beer, underrated. But this, the flavors, the toasty notes, reminded me of, as a kid, I used to peel the crust off of slices of bread. And I would save that for last because I loved it so much. And that's what this tasted like. So,
the crust of the bread, I get that, yeah.
You know, like the just the dark brown part.
Yeah.
Loved it. That's what this beer tasted like to me.
The opposite of my 10-year-old. Takes the crust off and it annoys me. I'm just like...
I just like being the contrarian. Wait, do you like the crust?
Tastes pretty similar to the rest of the bread. Just eat it.
Except for better. It's got more malts or something.
Well, especially on homemade bread, the crust is just delicious.
Oh, yeah.
If you buy the store-bought stuff, it's...
It's a little... It's nominally better. Homemade bread, way stinking better.
But, for sure.
All right, I feel like we're going long. That's going to be it for this episode. We'll link to some of the different resources we may have mentioned during this episode.
And we'll link to a 3-hour off-the-air conversation that Matt and I have about savings rate if you want to get even down and dirtier.
Oh, why not? Why not? But that's going to be it, buddy. Until next time.
Best friends out.
Best friends out.
Hey, your wife's been the one who's...
blows through the bus stop signs. Yeah. On accident.
Threw her under the bus stop.
She deserves it. She's done it twice now.
That's crazy.
Yeah.
I know she feels really bad.
Expensive tickets.
Yes. Upswell Marketing would like to remind you that when customers choose your small business, they're really choosing you. So focus on super serving your existing customers and let Upswell handle the pipeline generation of new leads and customers.
Upswell specializes in developing customized direct response campaigns and is now offering a no obligation free assessment of your current marketing strategies.
Not to mention, new customers also receive 15% off their first order when they mention that they heard about Upswell on this podcast. For more information, visit upswellmarketing.com. That's upswellmarketing.com.
I'm Katia Adler, host of The Global Story. Over the last 25 years, I've covered conflicts in the Middle East, political and economic crises in Europe, drug cartels in Mexico. Now I'm covering the stories behind the news all over the world in conversation with those who break it. Join me Monday to Friday to find out what's happening, why, and what it all means. Follow The Global Story from the BBC wherever you listen to podcasts.
Supercharge your work decks with AI-powered Canva presentations. All you do is start with a prompt. You describe your presentation in a few words, and Canva presentations will generate captivating slides that you can then customize in seconds.
Canva presentations are designed for every workplace and every department. Whether you work in sales, marketing, HR, ops, and more, Canva presentations can generate any deck you want for work. Sales decks, marketing presentations, onboarding plans, you name it. Any department can save time on any presentation with AI.
Generate slides in seconds with Canva presentations at canva.com. Designed for work.